Welcome to Geek Actually, episode 49 for the 28th of August, 2009. And now we are actually having a big boost in listeners over the last couple of weeks. So I thought we better do a proper introduction this week. My name is David McVeigh. I'm your head geek for the show. And we've now been doing this for just over a year, although we only have 49 episodes. It sounds a bit weird, but we took a couple of weeks over Christmas and so forth. I am a really big movie geek and a tech geek. I used to be an IT teacher as well. I was trained as a filmmaker, and I decided that it would be really good fun just to kind of get together and chit-chat about geeky-type stuff. And so we don't take ourselves actually too seriously here. We are not a major news service like a lot of podcasts you might hear. We do aggregate news because we find it interesting, and what we do is we openly discuss it. Sometimes we get it wrong, sometimes we get it right. And I am joined in studio by my very good friend, Josh Philpott. How are you, Josh?
I'm good, man.
Now, for those who are joining us for the first time and haven't been with us for 49 episodes, tell us a little bit about yourself, Josh.
Well, I am a geek like Dave. I have been working with computers since I think my hands had motor function. I currently work at a video game store and
which will remain nameless.
Which will remain nameless for legal reasons, I guess. And I pretty much just fill in the gaps between Dave's awesome voice speaking on the show, really.
Sorry.
Checking on the pride there. A little bit of ego in the background.
No, I just I don't see myself as having an awesome voice, but that's okay. Now, for those who are just joining us, here I am adjusting my seat here. If you're listening to the podcast only, you can actually watch this show live. We go live every Saturday morning, 11 a.m.-ish. Sometimes we start a little bit late. Sometimes we're on time. I don't think we've actually ever been on time, but that's okay.
We've tried.
We tried, but we have never got there. That is Australian Eastern Standard Time, which is UTC plus 10. For our U.S. listeners, and we actually have an abundance of U.S. listeners. So yeah. Just for you guys, if you do want to tune in live, it's actually 6 p.m. Pacific or 9 p.m. Eastern on Fridays because of the international dateline. Mm. So that's if you want to join us live. Now, on today's show, we will just give you a quick rundown. On today's show, Josh is going to fill us in on a little bit of gaming news, because that's what Josh really specializes mm-hmm. in for this show. And movies, of course. But yeah. he is my gaming god. We continue our coverage of the Great Internet Tech War of 2009. It's been a little bit quiet out there in the tech war, but we got a little bit of ancillary news.
Everyone's
there.
Staying in the trenches.
They are. I think everybody's moment. Keeping their head down at the moment. We have some tech news, including Apple's new operating system came out for Australian time. It came out yesterday. In America, it came out, I believe, today. Mm. So that's Snow Leopard, and that just came out. Nokia is releasing a netbook. They're entering the netbook arena, so we'll talk a little bit more about that as well. In entertainment news, we have everything from Spielberg, Green Lantern, David Fincher, and we're even getting into a little bit of cable TV news, because Foxtel had a slap on the wrist, so we'll have a chat with them. This week we have two feature film reviews. Mm-hmm. One is Catherine Bigelow's The Hurt Locker. Now, this is where we get into a little bit of an area, unfortunately, with being in an Australian podcast. We're reviewing Hurt Locker, which actually came out in the States a couple of weeks ago, but it is still playing in the cinema, so you can actually see it. Australia is actually not getting this film until when?
October, I believe.
October. So we're going to give a bit of a pre-review on that one, just for the American listeners. But we're also reviewing The Taking of Pelham 123. Now, America got this in June, and you're probably going, why the hell are we reviewing The Taking of Pelham 123 now? Australia only got it 2 days ago, okay? Mm. So we thought if we're going to review The Taking of Pelham 123, we're going to do it slightly differently because, you know, the Americans have already seen it. So we thought we'd take this as a slightly different tact, and that is that I've seen the original, and I'm actually a very big fan of the original with Robert Shaw and Walter Matthau, and Josh has not.
Nope.
So I thought what we would do is we would take this review from the opinion of a person who is going to compare it to the original film, and Josh is going to review it as a film standing alone on its own. And I think this might actually be kind of an interesting review, because I have very interesting feelings about this.
Okay.
But first we're going to get into some listener feedback, and I think we're going to start the listener feedback with Josh, who's actually got for us our iTunes reviews. So this is what we would normally call the Go Us section. But
interestingly enough, this week, it's not really Go Us. No, it's not. We had an interesting review. I'm not sure if anyone's recently been on iTunes.
Now, this is the Australian iTunes store for the first one.
The first one is from the Australian iTunes review. I'm reading this one out in particular because it's aimed directly at me. Basically, we've got somebody called MyStu2 who has given us some negative feedback. Our first negative feedback... giving us 2 stars. He says, thanks to Natalie Del Conte, I thought I was going to have a listen. I'd have a listen to this podcast. Unfortunately, in Australia, we are inundated with the Kiwi New Zealand accents in our media. Where?
But the first thing my lovely wife Katie said to this review when I read it out to her was, she goes, Where are the Kiwi accents on our television?
Anyway, we'll move past
that. We'll get past that part.
We'll get past that. Like, that's something we can accept, I guess. But I found one of the presenters' accents annoying. That's me right there.
And the reason we know that is because what's coming.
Yeah. And his obvious, that's one word, apparently, lack of knowledge and incorrect assertions that grate the most. Apparently, that's what annoyed him the most. Microsoft did not lose $1 billion. It was not a recall of the early Xboxes. They are, in fact, putting aside this amount of money. Okay, they're apparently putting aside. We'll finish the whole thing before we discuss this. They put aside this money to extend the warranty for the falling out of the RROD or the E74 issues, which is the red light issues or the red ring of death for those people in that thing. He talks about... let's stop there and we'll discuss this one as an issue.
Okay, first of all, can I just throw something in there? And can I just say that from a business point of view, if you take $1 billion of your profits and put it towards warranty of a fault... So that $1 billion is taken out of your profits and put into a warranty. You have lost $1 billion. That $1 billion is no longer yours to spend.
You can even say that money was put aside in advance. But if you use that money, that's money that comes out of your profits, which is a loss.
And it's coming out of your profits to fix an error.
Exactly. So, and furthermore, the recall did happen, buddy, because I was working in the industry at the time. And I personally boxed up those units and sent them back. So, your apparent attack on me on an issue that you say I'm wrong about is completely, in both categories, wrong. So I would just like to, before we even get to the next part of your review, I would like to say, don't call me a liar unless you have something to back it up. And if you want to rewrite me with a review, we will discuss why soon. I am more than happy to hear your comments if they are unbiased and not an attack at me, but actually backed up with maybe some links.
Now, Lisa N624 in the chat room has basically said, yeah, but say that without a Kiwi accent.
Ouch. It hurts.
I got to say right at this point in time that I actually don't think Josh has that strong a Kiwi accent. I mean, I've heard Kiwis, and Josh, I actually didn't know Josh was a New Zealander at the time when I first met him. So it kind of took me as a bit of a surprise. But look, I've got an American accent. My son has an Australian accent. My wife has an Australian accent. I tell you what, if this guy is hung up on accents, wait till Mirren gets on the show.
Oh, yeah.
So we will...
We'll move on.
Move on.
There's more. Oh, yes. Okay, so the next part that we get to is, then he talks about the Xbox Live arcade game Shadow Complex, telling us that this is where gaming is going and we should be buying it. I don't even know what the next thing is. It's got a G, then a star, then an E.
Look, if you're going to write insults to us, at least be literate about it. Come on.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that is, but we'll just move past that. That's not very... That's not very helpful to Microsoft, who is ripping everybody off by charging for Live and then using the ridiculous and unfair point system. Okay. Whoa. let's just start here by coming back to the thing. Number one, what has Live Service got to do with it? Live Service, as Dave was pointing out, a silver account doesn't cost you. You can actually purchase the games. And may I add, purchase. Purchase is the word we're coming to. Purchase the game using Microsoft points. And how is that an unfair point system? You pay money for points to buy games. It's no different than going into the store and picking up a copy
of something. Or buying
something
on Steam or whatever.
I assume then he's not a Mac user because he's obviously never had to buy something using
the App Store.
From the App Store, which works exactly the same way. And I think attacking the fact that I bring up the Shadow Complex game. Like, are you a doddering 90-year-old or something? Like, are you not aware that we are moving towards an industry which will be download-based? I am well aware in the gaming industry, standing behind a counter like I am, that people are becoming more and more obsessed with the idea of purchasing things online. It means I don't have to go out. If I wake up on a Friday morning and decide I want to play a game today, I can pull one down without leaving the house. I think that's a great thing, and I work behind the counter. I am used to the fact that I know that these people still come to me but will eventually not. Now, I am saying that the idea of moving with technology requires us to accept the fact that things are going to change.
And how would he cope? I mean, I'm assuming he's Australian, so he hasn't had to cope with, I mean, for the American listeners out there, I mean, you are dealing with Netflix on demand, and you are dealing with, I mean, we have it here as well with iTunes. You go online, you buy, I mean, so are we saying that iTunes is wrong because you shouldn't have to buy the music download?
I assume this guy doesn't pay for things very often then.
I'm sure he is a Pirate Bay user through and through.
But we shouldn't make that assumption.
No, we shouldn't make that
assumption.
Because
that and
look, look, we are only ragging on him because
of the final line.
The final line, because read it, and then I'll make my point.
Yes, okay, cool. The final line says, "And that's when I stopped listening." Okay, so he hasn't even given us the rest of a chance to redeem ourselves. Sorry, guys, get rid of
Now he's obviously mimicking the accent, so can you throw
thuck.
On can you put on a really thick accent for
thuck.
Us?
The thick Kiwi. So apparently I'm a thick Kiwi. Or try finding a smart one. Ooh, burn. Ooh. You might get an audience. You might grow your audience, sorry. Okay, so
So this guy actually has no idea what he's talking about, but can I also point out one thing? When putting reviews up about anything, not us, not whatever, I mean, let's make sure you keep to the facts and let's not get into personal attack. What he has said there is a racist comment. He has basically made an assertion about all Kiwis. He's gone on about your accent, and he has, Lisa Ann says, I'm sure glad I gave you guys a good review. No, we're only going on about this guy because it is a personal attack, and personal attacks are not on. Now, the good news about this is that iTunes has removed this review. So obviously somebody has reported him.
We didn't expect this. Now, I just want to point out for Lisa Ann's thing as well. I mean, I assume, you know, like it was a bit of humor. And we wouldn't usually do this. And the only reason that I am actually stating this is I am actually personally offended at this.
Yeah.
Because you are attacking me as a person. You're not giving me a review based on the way I perform or what I say, even though the earlier stuff may have been him attempting to do that, but they are just actually physically, mentally attacking me as a person. I can't change where I was born. I'm sorry that you find my accent offensive. If you do, you have the ability to not listen to the show.
Absolutely.
But to add a review against me based on my accent is something that I can't.
If he had just done his review and basically said, "I disagree with you about the Microsoft thing, and I don't think I don't think you're actually accurate,"
and then given us two stars, fine. We wouldn't have removed it. We wouldn't even be discussing it. Right? Well, actually,
we would have read it. I'll read all reviews now. Just to correct you, I'm saying we didn't remove it.
What I'm saying. Yeah. We wouldn't remove it.
No.
We wouldn't remove it if
I actually left it on there. I saw it there, and there is actually on iTunes. There is a part where you can report a comment, and my first reaction to that was to report it because I thought it was racist and it was a personal attack. And then I changed my mind and I said, no, I'm going to leave it there so that we can talk about it on the show. And then when I told Josh about it this morning, bang, it's gone. It's not even on iTunes anymore. So obviously somebody else also found it offensive. Good for you, whoever you are. And has actually reported it and it's been pulled down. So credit to Apple in this situation.
Yes, this is further proof that the system works.
Yeah, the system works. And really, personal attack is not actually necessary. If you disagree with our show or you don't like the sounds of our voices, don't listen. It's as simple as that. Our audience,
if you want to give us negative reviews, we will read them out and we will be completely subjective. We will understand what you were trying to say, right. And we will if it makes sense in any way or form, or it's something about the show, we may even change it. We may even redo the show.
But Lisa answers, maybe Molly Wood has a brother.
Maybe.
All right. So anyway, that's the negative review, and as I say, it actually doesn't actually count anymore because it's been pulled.
So. Exactly. So from there, we're wiping that clean,
yep.
And we're going to start a happy show.
And we're going to start a happy show again and say that we have American iTunes review.
Woo! Number five.
Now, this is the magic number five. Now, last week I discussed with Josh, I can't remember if I brought it up on the show or not, how it seems that there is actually some sort of...
five star.
It's some sort of mathematical calculation for the iTunes store to get you onto the featured list, where you have to have minimum of 5 ratings, and then you can start putting in just rating scores, and then you have to have listeners on top of that, and blah, 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 blah. Anyway, we never really hit the board on the American store, even though we have so many listeners, because we only had 4 reviews. We hit this 5th review, and suddenly, bang, the part where you can put down the average rating and all sorts of stuff all suddenly opened up. So thank you very much to...
Yep. To Mike from Albuquerque.
Who's in our chat room right now? Thank you very much.
Yes, Data Mike, thank you very much. The podcast is... the podcast goes from recent tech news to gaming news to movie news. At its end, in general, a fun and enthusiastic show. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And that's very, very kind of you. And that has actually put us over the top in the American store. And I'm very, very happy.
And we now have 5. And we can now see our rankings.
Now, I'd also like to point out that in the Australian store, in the American store, there's so many more podcasts and so many... Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. We have pretty much the same number of podcasts, but so many more listeners that we actually have not hit the featured pages yet. But we are on page 4 now of the Australian store, and we've pretty much consistently hang out on page 4 now, which is very nice. Now, I've got some other feedback, which is actually not iTunes related. We actually have a couple from other podcasts, which I quite like, but I've also got one about this cracked MacBook thing that we brought up last week.
Just quickly, Furball has just said the guy's poor manners, but maybe he's referring to the overpricing that the marketplace has for buying games at a retail store. I actually do agree with this. Just quickly, while we're still in the game section of things, actually we haven't even got there.
No, yet. Not yet.
No. Actually, you know what? I'll stop there and
save
I'll come
that for
back
the game
and
section.
I'll come back to the game when we do games.
Not a problem. Save that for the game section. I'm just going to read you on here. This is from Brad at Movie Fan House podcast, which is moviefanhouse.com, which is a lot of fun. You guys got to listen to this podcast. There's two guys who just love movies, and last week's episode they actually reviewed Inglourious Basterds, and it was a little bit like us.
Yeah.
One of them loved it and one of them hated it, and they were actually going, they were worse than us, they were going at each other's throats. So they are very entertaining to listen to. Dave actually sent us, said, "Hey David, just wanted to say that I really enjoyed your last show. I want to get in on the chat at some point, but Friday nights is usually the time when Charlie and I go see films for reviewing that week." So I do understand that completely. He says he just had a quick question. He was wondering how he could list his show on iTunes for other countries. Because we talk about the fact that we have, you know, American and Australian. He says, "I know that you are listed in the U.S. as well as Australia, and I think you said even in Russia." No, because Russia only has an app store.
Yeah.
But we have a huge number of Russian listeners. They're getting it from somewhere. Anyway, if you could share with me how you would do that, I'd much appreciate it. And then he says that if you want to promote your show, you could send us a voicemail. Unfortunately, voicemail lines cost us a great deal of money from Australia because we have to call internationally to do it. But we might do that for you at some point, Brad. But I will answer your question. To get listed onto the iTunes store in other countries, you do absolutely nothing. Your podcast is actually listed on international stores by default. It's,
wow.
So when you actually launch a podcast into, and the podcast address, the Phobos address that comes from iTunes is the same. It'll just take you to the localized store for you, but the actual podcast is hosted at exactly the same, because your podcast is actually being hosted from you. Apple doesn't actually hold any of the podcasts online. They are just feeding basically an RSS feed straight through their server. And once you list with iTunes, it will go across all of the, stores. All right, so that is the answer to you, Brad. Sorry, I actually hadn't switched my camera over for quite some time for those who are listening. Anyway, the next one is actually from Fox from Real Junkies, which is a Real Junkies podcast, which you can find on the iTunes store, and is actually, once again, a really fun podcast. It's a bunch of movie geeks who get around and discuss films, and they usually drink tequila while doing it, so you can imagine it's pretty a wild show sometimes. But he said, this is Fox from Real Junkies, episode 47 of Geek Actually is my first episode of yours. So I'm happy to see in brackets here, you do District 9. I totally agree with you, even though I always sound negative when I talk about it. That sounds a little bit like Josh. Even in Real Junkies number 28, which is when he reviewed it. Bonus, though, I loved your Alien recap. I do like Aliens better, but that's just in degrees. Alien is brilliant, and so is the novel. You've added a fan. I think we actually discussed that when we did it. Really, Alien and Aliens are such different films, and yeah. I love them both. I just actually put down Alien as being in the classic masterpiece category. And I don't think Aliens is quite there for me, but people disagree. That's fine. Different people have different feelings. Now, the last piece of feedback we have, and we're not going to read this whole email. I do apologize to you in advance, Scott from Brisbane, because it's a very long email. So I'm going to have to abridge it a little bit. But he's addressing the MacBook cracking issue that we brought up in our podcast a couple of episodes ago. Excuse me. He says, Dear David, today is the first day I've listened to your podcast. I listened to 2.5 episodes at work tonight and enjoyed them, smiley face. In response to your request for cracking MacBook stories, my mid-2007 MacBook first started developing fine cracks across front. I'm reading it as he wrote it, so some of the wording is a bit funny. Cross front, just over 1 year ago, as my hard disk drive had failed 2 weeks before warranty expired. I went into Mac One, Fortitude Valley, Brisbane, to get it fixed. They told me there was no hope of fixing crack, as well as Apple viewed this as user error. Mm. A few months went by, cracks got longer, and I heard on American podcasts that Apple Store was fixing. Last month, I went to Mac One Store and got usual terrible service. Now, I don't know this store at all. I'm just reading the emails. I'm not.
We have no bias against
you. I have no bias against the store. I'm actually not in Brisbane, so I can't actually tell you what this store is like. Just telling you what, I'm just relaying his experience. It goes on, he's got terrible service. The tech guy looked down his nose at him, said Apple only fixes the cracks if they're on the wrist pad. Apparently.
Oh, okay.
Then suggested that I may have dropped his machine. So he basically accused him of dropping his machine. He puts lots of exclamation points after that. He said his only help was, they said, keep it, take photos, email photos to Apple, and wait 1 week for a response. Then, if okay, would take another week to fix. I left the shop, crack book in hand. Okay. We only have one lousy Apple retail store in Queensland. Now, just to be very clear about this, there aren't that many Apple retail stores in Australia. We have two in Sydney, there's two in Melbourne now, I believe, and there's one in Brisbane. So there aren't that many of the official Apple stores. And personal experience, I've actually had very good experience at the Apple store. So,
mind you, we have some very, very good Apple stores here.
We have some very good Apple stores. Anyway, he didn't have such a great experience. And he says, we only have one lousy Apple retail store in Queensland, and it's on the Gold Coast. So 1 week later, I drove down there. He barely looked at his laptop before happily taking it in to be fixed. Good for them. He says, I now have AppleCare warranty, so I'm not sure if that helped. The genius said 5 to 7 days to fix. 5 days later, they call me to say part has come in. We will fix it ASAP. Day 7, I stopped in to see what the delay is. Calling Sydney tech support, useless, of course. Sorry, the part has come in. We'll try and fix it close of business day. I kicked up a fuss. Talk to the manager. Tech guy comes. They'll do it as a priority job, 3 to 4 hours. 1 week later, I do that. They drop it off 4.5 hours later. No call. I go back. Sorry, we're busy on another call. So they basically gave him the runaround like crazy. Basically, here, though, the final story to this is he says, next day, 4:50 p.m., no call from Apple on my supposed priority repair. I call them. Oh, yeah, it's ready, she says. Too late to pop down to Gold Coast then. I mean, he's in Brisbane, right? So I know this was a long story, probably too annoying to read on the show. Not at all. But that was my saga. In compensation for his 4x1 hour trips to the Gold Coast, he did get a $50 iTunes card.
I'm not really sure whether I'd be satisfied with that.
No, but, I'm not entirely sure. And I did actually write back to him to confirm whether or not it was an official Apple store that he went to. And he says, yes, the real and only Apple store in Queensland. And he says that a friend put him onto the show and he loves it. So he says he works a lot. What's he say? He says, I love this part. He says, it's helping kill my 5-hour day data entry work. So obviously he listens to the show. All right, so I actually, I'm really sorry he had such a bad experience, except he got it fixed. So I guess the positive side of it is that they, you know, if you push and kick up a big enough stink, they will fix it eventually. So anyway, so that's our listener feedback for this week. I know that was kind of long, but
we had a lot of feedback, especially on my end. But we needed to get that off our chest, because if we didn't, it wouldn't have been the same.
Ben says he would have asked for a free touch.
I know, and I've written damn right, Ben.
Damn right. After that much dicking around the town, especially with the cost of petrol at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, like $50, man, I doubt that would even cover your petrol from Brisbane to and back 4 times. But anyway, okay.
Look. If you want to send feedback to the show, you can send feedback at feedback@geekactually.com, or you can use a contact form at geekactually.com. It's up in the top bar. Or you can put reviews on the iTunes store.
And we will be nice. We're usually very nice. Look, I apologize.
I will read out all reviews, good or bad, and if you have something constructive to say about the show,
we will not be that harsh.
We will not be that harsh. It's just if you're going to take personal swipes, then you're going to get swiped back. It's as simple as that. All right, we're going to move straight into gaming news, and we will continue that thing about the Xbox before we.
Well, we might as well quickly go through that. I have to tend to agree with him at this stage. I was actually quite disturbed. When I came on to find the Games on Demand starting in Australia especially. Oh. And we recently got a couple of titles. I won't name particular ones, but basically we've had a couple of titles pop up that are available in stores. And the prices are horrendous. Just one in particular was Burnout Revenge, which I honestly we haven't had new for a while. Where I work, but our second-hand copies are under 50, and they're selling it for $80.
I also have to say, I don't think the pricing of the Xbox Store is live actually
games,
that extreme.
Live games, that's a totally different story, and this is where I come into it. 1,200 points for Shadow Complex is amazing. You will get every dollar out of what you pay for that.
Well, 1,200 points is what? That's about...
1,200 is just under 15, it'd be about $20 or $18 or something like that.
$20 to $18. And you consider that if you go in and buy a retail copy of a game nowadays, you're upward, this is Australian dollars, by the way, guys, you're upward and pushing $80, $90 for a new game. I noticed that Left 4 Dead is still on PC, is still $99 or something like that to buy. And I noticed that the new Batman game coming out on PC is coming out, $129?
$120.
And I know in the States they're slightly cheaper, but take into account the exchange rate and everything else.
We still have.
So I don't see 1,200 points that expensive for a game. And I mean, if you go to Steam and you buy yourself a copy of, you name it, Left 4 Dead is $39 American,
as opposed to 100.
If you go in and buy yourself a copy of the original Half-Life, which is an old game,
That's changed recently. We just had a drop in the PC version of Orange Box. It's now only $50.
All right, well, still, $50. So you go buy yourself a copy online, that's $10 US. That's about $15, $16 Australian dollars to buy a game that is, what, 8 years old, 9 years old now? So it's not really that expensive for a new game. I disagree with him completely.
But okay, cool. Anyway, so moving along, two important points. Number one, finally, after an incredible dry spell of games, we have Batman coming out on the 3rd in Australia. I assume it's the same for the US unless they've already got it. But yes, Australian users, be aware, it's coming out. The reviews have been amazing. 9.4 on IGN, which hasn't happened for a while for a game. This kind of game anyway. Just across the board, everyone seems to love it. The lowest review I think I've seen was an 8. It will be a game that will give you every dollar. Once you finish the game, there are also challenges available as well, even though it's only about, I think, 10 to 12 hours long, which I still think is a decent time. Limit for a game, really. I mean, 12 hours if you play it correctly.
I mean, when you consider that, what was it, the game Black, I think it was, which was actually supposed to be pretty good.
It was like 6 hours.
It was like less than that. I think some people finished it off in 5.
Maybe I'm slow.
I didn't play it because I was told the gameplay was really short on it, so I actually decided not to spend the money.
Maybe worth getting it now. Anyway, the other thing is a piece of news for the Australian users. Americans, I think, have already had this announced. Australia, the Xbox will be having a price drop to combat PlayStation's a drop for last week when they were releasing the Slim model for $499. Xbox will now be releasing their Elite, which is a 120 gigabyte thing that also comes with all the HDMI cables and also apparently a different cooling system. But I believe now the other ones are using that
and
anyway.
And less Rings of Death, maybe?
Yeah, I think it's about the same. But yeah, 120 gig hard drive and the high definition cables inside the box. Those are coming for a standard price now of $449, which is about $50 more than the Pro console was. Anyone that's wondering, I am too, what will happen with the rest of the consoles, because even working in the industry, we have not been told whether the Pro consoles, which were the 60 gigabyte models, will be even getting a price drop.
I reckon before Christmas, we're going to see a price drop.
Assuming they even do anything like that. Like, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, I know they do come with free games at the moment, but even so, that doesn't equate to 60 gigabytes of hard drive space. So I assume there will be a price drop, but what I really want to know is the arcade model, because to get people consoles, to me, is the more important point. Those people that aren't likely to go online yet, the people that just want to play an Xbox console, $299 when you're paying $349.
Furball's just written into the chat room, $199 on Pro.
Yeah, $199 on Pro is that American, though, Furball? Because I know that we are looking at a... Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Ben says, are we recording this week? Yes, Ben, we're recording this week.
yeah, so if it's $199, I assume we will get a price drop. But considering the news isn't actually officially announced yet, it comes the 22nd, I think, or something like that,
right,
is when we officially drop the price. So it's just a heads up for people at this stage. I assume there will be a price drop. I assume, like he says... I'm thinking $249, which would be $199.
$249. Yeah, it could be close.
It could be $249. In Australia, close. I would think $249 would be probably the difference in the end. But yeah, that's all I have for gaming. It's a bit of a quiet week.
It's actually a pretty quiet week all around. I mean, we're going to cut through a couple of these. We got a couple of big ones in the middle, so we're just going to kind of move around the small stuff. Basically, we're going to move into the Great Tech War of 2009 coverage. I did receive, thank you very much for the email I got, which actually had all sorts of wonderful sound effects. I haven't cut them together yet. So for next week, we will have a theme, I promise you. But for the Great Tech War of 2009 coverage, just a couple of really quick ones because it's been kind of quiet on the front. But we will say that the FCC, as we reported last week, sent out a letter to Apple, Google, and AT&T basically saying, please explain what's going on about Google Voice.
They're like the parent coming over the top and separating the kids out be like, now what happened?
And the FCC is kind of toothless anyway. But anyway, people, they answered. And I'll just sum this up by saying that AT&T basically came out, and, like the kid in the cookie jar said, we didn't do it. They basically said, we had nothing to do with it, nothing to do with us whatsoever. Apple wrote a thesis, which I'm going to just put on my camera for a minute. You can actually see it's 5 pages long. It goes on and on and on. I actually downloaded and read through their thesis. I'm not going to read out the whole thing because, God, it's long. But basically, they wrote this big, long thing about the explanation of what the App Store does. But the most telling part of the whole thing was question one. And they said, why did Apple reject the Google Voice application? And the question goes on to a much bigger question. If you go to apple.com, they actually published this, and you can go have a look at it. Basically, they said, contrary to published reports, Apple has not rejected the Google Voice application and continues to study it. I don't buy it. I don't buy it. I think everybody is backpedaling. I think that's what this is. I think everybody is backpedaling, and I think Apple... they go on to talk about the fact that they alone make the final decisions. AT&T had nothing. Apple is acting alone. They go on and on and on about it. But they actually say that the reason why they rejected the Google Voice application is because it replaces core functions of the phone. And they said that if one of the conditions of the Apple iPhone is that you cannot replace any of the core functions of the phone itself. They're saying Google Voice application replaces Apple's visual voicemail by routing calls through a separate Google Voice telephone number that stores any voicemail, preventing voicemail from being stored on the phone. It says similar SMS text messages are managed through Google Hub, replacing the iPhone's text message feature. And in addition, the iPhone user's entire contacts database is transferred to Google servers. Now, basically, we don't generally out there in the world, people are saying that they don't think any of this is actually true, because Google Voice is an app. It has to be run to actually do these things. If it's not running, it's not changing anything. The core features of the phone stay the same. Mm. I have never played with Google Voice. I cannot talk in any authority about it. I just reading this sounds to me like Apple is backpedaling. I think the future, I think, in fact, even just in this next week, we are going to see more about this. So we will come back on this one. And last but not least, Google's response to it was redacted. They basically just turned around and said, nah, redacted. Everything's redacted. So in other words, they either... All right, it's, and this is a personal opinion. They either upfront lied, and now they're redacting their entire comment, or they are bound by some sort of confidentiality agreement, and they refuse to actually say anything publicly.
Do you really think, though, that it would be something like they had lied through their teeth?
Because, I don't think so.
No, because, I mean, like, Apple wouldn't go to this much extent.
No, I think what they've done is they've talked to the FCC, and they said, we're not making any of this public. If you want to know about it, we'll talk to you. Mm. But they're not making anything public, and I think that's what it comes
down to.
Well,
that's funny,
to.
Because they should know that the internet will make it public, whether they like it or not. Not. Here we are on the show doing the exact same thing.
Absolutely. And you know what? I wait with bated breath to find out more about it because I think it's very funny. But you know what? On Apple news, Apple has fired back at the with the release of their new operating system. They have fired back at Microsoft, and they are squarely taking aim at the Microsoft Laptop Hunter ads again. This is actually the second time they've actually taken pot shots at it. Now, the thing about the Apple Mac ads, whether you like Macintosh or not, we have to admit that the Mac ads are actually quite humorous, whether we agree with them or not. I actually quite like them. I think they're carried very much by...
Look, I'm a PC user. Yeah. And I still like the
and I yeah, exactly. And I think they're carried by John Hodgman and Justin Long. I mean, absolutely carried by these two characters.
Justin Long, especially. The British
actually redid them with their own actors, and they're not nearly as clever because the actors aren't charming enough to carry it through. I mean, John Hodgman is just charming, you know? He's a little
You know what? I have to say, and as much as this may be a little bit nasty, I honestly think of Justin Long as the core symbol of what they are like Apple users as a thing. Like, I'm not saying they're stupid. I'm not saying that they're intelligent. But it's just that kind of I think that my favorite way it's ever been put is on Chuck. The whole we're IT artists. Yes. And I just admire that kind of like the fact that their unit is better. But, you know, like, they don't actually, like, hold it over people. They're just like, well, Mac can do that. And it's the same thing I constantly get from Mac users.
And let's not forget that the ads are not actually – they don't actually portray PC as horrible. In fact, John Hodgman is actually really lovable as the PC guy trying to deal with these problems. And I find him absolutely charming. Anyway, we're going to play two of the three new ads. The third ad is actually kind of visual, and so I'm not going to play it on the show because the audio listeners aren't going to get it. If you want to see them, go to apple.com, and you can actually watch them in better quality. But we're going to play two of them here today. So here we go. Let's see if we can make this work for a second.
Hello, my man. And I'm a PC.
And I'm looking to buy a great computer.
Well, allow me to introduce the top-of-the-line PC.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Hey.
Well, I want a computer with a big screen.
Look no further.
And a really fast processor.
Some say I'm too fast.
And I want one that just works, without thousands of viruses and tons of headaches.
Look, lady, any PC you get's gonna have those problems.
Well, I think I'll go with Mac.
Great.
When you're ready to compromise, you call me.
Isn't that wonderful? When you're ready to compromise, call me. I just love when he comes out and he says, I want something really fast. Some say too fast. And for those who don't know who that is, that's Patrick Warburton, who actually played the Tick in the live-action version of the Tick, amongst many,
and of course,
many things.
And Joe on Family Guy. No,
Joe on Family Guy, and Elaine's boyfriend in Seinfeld, and he was in the M&M ads. And Patrick, I love Patrick Warburton. And he's actually currently in his own sitcom as well, which I can't remember what it's called. But I just love Patrick Warburton. I love his delivery. I always remember the M&M ads when he says it's a rule. He goes, whose rule? I just love him. Anyway, so we've got one more. And once again, the other thing is Apple's pulling out the big guns here because we had Patrick Warburton in that one. And this one actually guest stars Robert Loggia, who you'll recognize from many a mob film. So here we go. We'll try this one out and see how we go with this.
Hello, I'm a Mac. And I'm a PC. Mac, it's been kind of a rough quarter, so I brought in a trainer to get me back on top of my game.
Come on, get started, you bucking of bolts. PC Mag rated Mac number one in customs. of support.
Are you just going to take that?
No.
PC World's readers called Mac number one in reliability. He's laughing at you.
I'm not laughing at you.
He's number one in customer satisfaction. What are you?
Okay, maybe we could try some positive reinforcement at this point.
Sure. You're doing a good job, Mac.
Thanks.
Hey.
Very good. Try some positive reinforcement. You're doing a good job, Mac.
Yeah. No, as I was just saying to you while we were off the thing, my favorite line of that is just Justin Long's one, though, where he's like, he's laughing at you, and then it flicks to Justin, he's like, I'm not laughing at you.
So charming, charming stuff. I really like this. The other one, just for those who, because we aren't showing the third one, actually has Justin Long standing there, and a girl comes up and says, I want to buy a PC, and he goes, buy a PC, and but I want something that doesn't have any viruses. He goes, no, buy a PC. She goes, no, but I want this. He goes, oh, no, really, buy a PC. And then as soon as she walks off, he does the Mission Impossible thing and pulls off the mask and everything, and it's PC underneath the... and Justin Long just walks on and goes, I don't want to know. So go and have a look at those at apple.com. If you're an Australian user, you actually have to go to the American Apple Store, just apple.com, because we don't get all the ads over here because they advertise different things. So some of those won't show on the Australian store. But I always find going straight to the American store is a great way of finding that sort of stuff out. Okay, we're going to move ourselves directly into tech news. And I guess really, because we're talking Apple, we'll just change the order of two of our stories, because we actually had... we had one story first, but we'll change the order and we'll say that that Apple has actually released its new operating system. Now, just for those who are wondering what it's all about, the Snow Leopard, or 10. What are we up to now? 10.7, I think it is. 10.7? 10.6. 10.7. Anyway, Snow Leopard. Look for the Snow Leopard on the box. What is the big deal about Snow Leopard? On the surface, it actually just looks like Leopard. I mean, it really is an under-the-hood upgrade more than a surface upgrade. They've added a few new bells and whistles. The icons, movies play in actually in the icon view, and they've added scroll bars to the stacks and so forth. But really where it all comes down to is that they have completely rewritten a whole bunch of the code. One of the things that is most fascinating is you actually recover gigabytes of space on your hard drive by this install. They've compressed stuff down like crazy. I think the last thing I heard was probably Ben from Ben's Tech Show can actually correct me on this because he's in our chat room now. I think it's anything between 5 and 7 gig you recover from your hard disk for this install. So it's really quite an amazing install. But where the real big changes come is that it's actually implementing. First of all, it's fully 64-bit now, so they've actually discarded 32-bit altogether. It is not compatible with non-Intel Core 2 Duo processors. So basically, if you have one of the old Power PCs, you cannot upgrade to Snow Leopard. This is now going Intel only. This is actually something that Microsoft actually can't do. Because Microsoft has such a user base, such a large user base, they can't just basically say, from this point onwards, we're now here. Mm. Apple, because it only has a small percentage of the marketplace, can basically make these sweeping gestures where they basically say, no longer backwards compatible, you know?
Yeah.
And I understand why Microsoft can't do that, because they have such an enormous user database. Anyway, this is now 64-bit. It's now only Intel Core. It's only now Intel processors. A couple of things that they've introduced here which are really interesting. One is OpenCL. The entire graphics is now the entire graphics system is now an open source program that has actually been instigated by Apple called OpenCL. And what this actually does is it allows programs to be written to address the GPU on a graphics card for non-graphics related issues, which speeds up your computer. So when your computer is not dealing with super high-end graphics and so forth, it can then borrow processor time straight off of the GPU. So hopefully the OpenCL standard will actually filter across all of the platforms be a new de facto standard for graphics, because this is shaping up to be something very interesting. They've also introduced something called Grand Central, which is a brand new way of paging the cores. So if you've got multiple cores on your Mac, basically it uses a different instruction set now so that it can actually control traffic better between all the different cores.
Good stuff.
So that's supposed to speed things up quite a lot as well. And of course, it's now Exchange supported, Microsoft's Exchange. It's supported out of the box. So even on a PC, you actually have to buy Exchange to put onto a PC. Apples are now 100% Exchange supported out of the box. So hopefully we're going to see them take a bigger swipe at the corporate world.
And I believe you were saying that there was some problem with the fake version.
Yeah, we're going to get to that in 1 second. Just to let people know, in Australia, the pricing is different. In America, go to your Apple store to find your pricing. But in Australia, this is the last part, which is the major swipe at Microsoft. You can actually get this upgrade for your Leopard machine. If you're currently a Leopard user, the last version of the operating system, you can upgrade for $39.
Wow.
Or you can buy a family pack of 5 licenses for your family for $69.
Man, I hope they do that with Windows 7.
Oh. No, they're not.
Well, you never know as a response, man.
No, they've known about this for weeks. We've been wondering if they're going to do something like this for Windows 7. There is some sort of family pack available for Windows 7, but it's still overpriced. What the hell is that?
I don't know.
I just heard a ring. Anyway, so that's the Snow Leopard news. But just beware, there has already been pirate versions of Snow Leopard kicking around. And there was an article on CNET that basically said that if you are one of those sort of people who doesn't want to pay for it, now I would actually say at that pricing, why wouldn't you pay for it? But if you are one of those sort of people who don't want to pay for it and you go hitting the torrent sites or you go Googling Snow Leopard, beware that there is actually a fake Snow Leopard distro already out there, and it is dangerous. It does contain malware and so forth. So be aware. This is the same thing that happened when their version of the Office Suite, Pages and so forth, iWork, came out last time. Pirate copies actually contained a Trojan. Now, speaking of Trojans, this moves on to our next tech story, but just one very quick thing on that. One of the interesting things about Snow Leopard is it actually contains a malicious software tool, which for a company that has always boasted that no malicious software can ever hurt you, blah, 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 they are now basically saying, we have a tool in here. There was a lot of speculation as to whether or not it has inbuilt virus protection, but that's not the case. It turns out it's a little bit like Microsoft's malicious software removal tool. It's built into the system, and apparently it's very small because it actually only accounts for 2 Trojans. Because there are only 2 known Trojans at this point for the OS X system. They're both concepts, but apparently this removal tool is now built in there. But this moves us into another piece of tech news, which is that last week we talked about Symantec and their 100 dirtiest websites and, you know, sites that could cause you damage. Well, McAfee, not to be outdone, has come out with their own survey, which has basically come out with searches that can cause you damage, and they've hit the celebrity market. And it has actually now been declared by McAfee that Jessica Biel is the most dangerous celebrity on the web, followed closely behind by Jennifer Aniston. If you go searching for...
Which are not my 2 choices. I mean, I know it would come down to personal thing, but Jennifer Aniston?
I know, but for some reason they are still heavily searched for things like pictures and wallpapers and so forth, and a lot of the sites contain malicious malware on sites that actually feature those
Jennifer
people.
Aniston.
Actresses Angelina Jolie and Megan Fox tied in 8th place.
8th?
I know. I would have put them much higher than that. Just having a look here. What else? Brad Pitt is on the list.
Where's he?
Do we have... Brad Pitt is... Ooh, no, it doesn't say where he is on the list. It's not a complete list I'm looking at. It's just an article about it. But basically, yeah, Brad Pitt's on the list. Here it is. Brad Pitt fell to 10th.
Oh.
But last year, he was first.
Well, he is getting old.
Anyway, I think there's a fascination with Jessica Biel because everybody wants to see her to go naked, and she won't go naked. So I think
Yet.
All right, I've just covered up my show notes. Where the hell have my show notes disappeared to? There they are. Okay. All right, so Microsoft, we're just going to blow through that one because it was kind of to be predicted. Microsoft has launched an appeal for that stay, an appeal to stay the injunction against Word, which theoretically has to go off sale in... just on a month now. So they're hopefully going to get that pulled apart. The expansion to that is apparently OpenOffice was examined by the company who hold the patent and who are basically have done this against Microsoft, and they have declared that OpenOffice does not infringe their patent. So OpenOffice is still widely available.
Woo!
Woo! For those who like OpenOffice.
Hands up.
Yep. All right, Nokia has entered into the netbook arena, apparently. Well, they haven't entered it yet. They're entering it September 2nd. They're releasing a, what do they call it? They had a wonderful name for it. I didn't actually highlight it this time, but they've actually got a lovely name for it. The Booklet is what they're calling it.
Booklet.
They're actually refusing to call it a netbook. They're actually preferring the term mini laptop, because it's a really, really small laptop. But they're not calling it a netbook because it's fully featured. It's a Windows machine. It's only a 10-inch screen. It's running an Atom processor. You can connect via 3G or HSPA or Wi-Fi or Bluetooth. Mm. Apparently, it has a hot swappable 3G card, which is the part that really intrigues me.
The SIM card. Yeah,
so you can literally pull your SIM card out of your mobile phone and plug it straight into your laptop.
Which is actually really annoying to do, but still quite cool.
But
in kind concept. Of
cool, yeah. Now, they're actually saying that if they just release these laptops, we don't have any details on pricing yet, not until September 2nd, apparently. Market availability, detailed specifications, and pricing will be announced at Nokia World September 2nd. It's looking very interesting. The most impressive part to the whole thing is it's got a 12-hour battery.
Which I think that's incredible.
Like, that is amazing.
As someone that uses a netbook, which I won't hold up, but I'm using a netbook at the moment, it's 6 hours as an average. So that's double.
And considering that it has all those antennas, all that connectivity, and it has, it's got HD outputs, it's got an HDMI slot on the side, it's got an HD screen, this should not have that much battery. I don't know how they've done that. It'll be very interesting to see. But anyway, so
maybe it's a netbook with a giant battery on the back.
Apparently it's got a glass screen like the Apple laptop. Ooh. So that's very nice too. So which would actually account for just a little bit more of its weight. All right, so we're going to move into film news. It says, Furball says, don't worry, Megan will be number one soon. Yeah, after Jennifer's body, I reckon. Everybody's going to want screen caps on it. Anyway. Okay, moving right along into film news. We're going to blow through some of this pretty fast because some of it's just kind of just a weak update, basically. Let's just say that we reported here a couple of weeks ago that Green Lantern had been cast, and Green Lantern was a Go project, and Green Lantern was going to be shot here in Sydney's Fox Studios, and we were all very excited about it. Well, Warner Brothers does it again. So apparently, now that the dollar has changed and our dollar is a little bit stronger and they hadn't put any deals in place, they are now rethinking coming to Australia, and they're looking for other places to shoot it because, of course, they didn't set any deals in advance, which is such a Warner Brothers thing to do when it comes to DC product. They don't plan their DC product stuff very well. No. This is why it takes so long to get any superhero films out of Warner Brothers, because they agonize over it all so much that it ends up not happening. Mm-hmm. Shall we talk Justice League last year? Let's not talk Justice League last year. Okay. Anyway, so they are actually looking for... apparently, they are in negotiations at the moment with the government to see if they can actually get some tax incentives. If they can get some tax incentives, they might stay. If they can't, then they are going to move on. Now, mind you, two other American productions, including the latest Narnia film, are shooting in Australia right now, and that's because they organized tax breaks and stuff before they came, you know? So instead of just booking the studio and wondering if magically thinking it might happen.
When I think of Warner Brothers, for some reason I just think of their team just running around with giant piles of paper with papers flying out.
Red tape. Like,
yeah. So we've got this one.
it's just ridiculous. Anyway, apparently Michael Crichton, even though he's been dead for, a year now, has actually written another book. Go figure. No, apparently he had one more book written that was discovered. It's being published in November. It's called Pirate Latitudes, and it's a good old-fashioned pirate book. We have the full synopsis on geekactually.com. You can go and have a read of it. Filmcast actually published the synopsis. Mm. But the most interesting part of this is that Steven Spielberg has already optioned the book. Now, you've got to remember that Steven Spielberg and Michael Crichton had a long-term relationship with the Jurassic Park films and ER on television, amongst others. Mm. And he has optioned it to produce a film of it because he's always wanted to make a pirate movie. I guess he's forgotten he did Hook, but
I think we all did.
But apparently he's always wanted to direct a pirate movie, and he may even direct Pirates Latitudes. So be very interesting to see what happens with that in the future. James Cameron. What's his name? The other one. McGee. McGee.
For anyone with sensitive ears, they may want to cover them for a sec.
Okay, if you haven't heard this already, McGee makes fucking liars out of everybody, all right? But then we carry an explicit tag, so I don't care. McGee basically looks like, and this is opinion only, looks like he may have lied to us one more time. This is in regards to the nude scene in Terminator Salvation. Apparently, Moon Glove, what's her name?
Moonblood something. I don't know. I only ever
Moonbloodgood. That's her name. Moonbloodgood was apparently supposed to do a topless scene. If you see the film Terminator Salvation, you know
it's
where
very obvious.
You know where
it
was supposed to be. There's a huge cut that's like it's. We talked about it on our show. Go back and have a listen to the review. However,
God, I wish I was there for that.
The
one.
Director's cut. That was actually the episode just before you came on.
All right.
The director's cut is coming out on DVD, and it has been put forward to the MPAA for rating, and apparently has received its R rating. And I'd just like to point out, McGee actually said he did not remove the nude scene from Terminator Salvation. His words, he did not remove it for the purposes of the PG-13 rating. He removed it because he didn't feel it was right for the story and didn't help the story move along, blah, blah, blah. I now quote you from the MPAA, for the R rating, it is rated R for the director's cut of Terminator Salvation coming out on DVD, rated R for some violence and brief nudity. So if it wasn't necessary for the story, why in the director's cut has it been put back in?
Ooh, I have a reason.
Oh, he has a reason. Josh, floor is yours.
Okay. We all know how shit that movie was, so I have the inside belief personally that this is probably added in so that all of those geeks and nerds that thought your movie were terrible will go back and watch it again to see her boobs.
Well, there is that. Look, I'm going to watch it again to watch your boobs. Right?
Right there.
Mark an audience. There we go. I just want to point out that Data Mike has actually pointed out in our chat room the Green Lantern live action movie just doesn't make sense to me. Green Lantern isn't known very well with the general populace. I actually disagree a little bit. Green Lantern's actually been around for a long time, and he is actually quite a popular character. But that being aside, he is no less known than Iron Man. And Iron Man was a massive success. And remember, when Iron Man was actually being produced, lots of people were actually going, Iron what? What? The general populace weren't that aware of Iron Man. Depending on how they market it, they can make anything sell.
I tend to agree. I kind of take his side in the fact that I don't think the general populace knows it very well, but I will say this is any story, and this is what we have to continue to remember, if handled correctly, mm-hmm. can make it good on the big screen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, and you know, if it's well done, it looks slick, and it's well marketed, people will go. And I, you know, Green Lantern is a lot of fun. He also says, don't get me wrong, he's been reading Green Lantern since the late 60s. Good on you. Because Green Lantern's great fun. I love Green Lantern because I like the humor of the things that he produces with his ring, because, of course, it is... Each ring produces the items that he needs from the person who's using it. And so, of course, his items are often very humorous, like, baseball mitts and stuff like that, because it's just the way he thinks. So I actually quite like the Hal Jordan Green Lantern, though. I'm not a big fan of the later Green Lantern. I like the Hal Jordan years. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. We're going to move on. We've got two more, and then we're going to get into these film reviews. This one's really quick because it's a censorship issue, and you know they always get my goad. Foxtel has been wrapped over the knuckles, basically, by the Australian Communications and Media Authority. For the American listeners, Foxtel is pretty much our one and only cable provider. We also have AllStar, but they're like our big cable provider here. They've been wrapped over the knuckles because they're showing a lot of material that they're now saying contains sexual content and or nudity that exceeds what would normally be an MA 15 plus rating. Now, my argument is, who gave them the MA 15 plus rating in the first place? All right, that's a whole different issue. But they are being wrapped over the knuckles, and it looks like they are no longer going to be able to show R-rated content. I'm sorry, I pay for this goddamn service. If I want to see boobies, show me boobies, you know?
Fickle.
It's not free to air TV. It's subscription television. I pay for it. I should be allowed to watch what I want when I want. Damn it.
All right. Cool.
Last piece of film news, and we'll move on to our film reviews. And this one actually, I've written a blog post about this already, so we won't harp on it. Go to geekactually.com. You can read about it. When I first heard that they were making a Facebook movie, I have to say I was not very interested. I thought, why on earth? However, new details surfaced over this last week, which was that it is based on a book called The Accidental Billionaires, written by Ben Mezrich, who actually wrote the book Bringing Down the House, which the film 21 was based on, which I quite like the film 21. It is being produced by Kevin Spacey's team, the same team who produced 21. They have now signed a director. That director is David Fincher, who directed Seven and Fight Club and The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. Right here, I'm getting more and more excited as I speak to you. And the last feather in the cap is that the screenplay is being written by Aaron Sorkin, who wrote The West Wing and The American President. And I got to tell you, I am now really, really excited about this project. The film is actually not about a social networking site. It is about the founding of Facebook, and it's the story of Zuckerberg and so forth. And it'll be very interesting, I think, to see how they actually handle all of this material.
I hope, because of the previous look at like a story that actually happened. David Fincher's work on Zodiac. He did Zodiac, right?
He did Zodiac, yeah.
Yeah, I thought that movie was horrible.
You know, it's actually the one Fincher film I have not seen. But then again, I didn't like Alien 3, which was his first feature film.
Exactly.
But so I love Seven, and I love The Game. I didn't like the ending, but I loved the rest of the film.
Really? You didn't like
I didn't like the ending. I thought the ending was pat, but we won't go into that right now.
Okay.
Maybe we'll save that for a retro review at some point. I actually thought the ending was... a word for it would be silly. And I thought the ending was silly. And not the ending, not the punchline, what led to the punchline. It's that moment on top of the building. You know what I'm
all
talking
right, cool.
about.
We can
you know
say,
what I'm
we
talking
can do
about.
That
anyway,
for a review
and Benjamin Button, I actually quite enjoyed as well. And I love Fight Club. And I just thought Fight Club was fabulous. So,
oh, well, I'll be interested to see.
Yeah. And look, Aaron Sorkin is a brilliant, brilliant writer.
I totally agree.
No doubt in my mind that the screenplay is going to be sensational. Okay, that brings us to the end of film news, and we're going to move into our feature reviews. And why is my screen going black? Oh, there we go. There it's back. All right, we're going to move into some feature reviews. What we're going to do, we're approaching the Taking a Pelham 1-2-3 as a slightly different review, and because it's currently in release here, and it's already been in release in the States, we're going to probably go into a spoiler zone on that and the whole bit. I think what we're going to do is we're going to review Hurt Locker first, because it's not out here yet, and it is just in release in the cinemas now, and we're not going to go into much of a spoiler zone on Hurt Locker. We're just going to review it as a film, and then we'll save our main body for Taking a Pelham 1-2-3, because we've actually got a little bit more. Let's have a look at the trailer for Hurt Locker real quick.
Welcome to Camp Victory.
Oh, Camp Victory? I thought this was Camp Liberty.
Oh, no, they changed that about a week ago. Victory sound better.
All right. So what do you got?
The car has been parked illegally. The suspension is sagging. There's definitely something heavy in the trunk.
Interesting.
What's he doing?
I'm gonna die. I'm gonna die comfortable.
How many bombs have you disarmed?
873.
873?
You're a wild man, you know that?
That was too bad. Our first time working together. What do you think?
I think us working together means I talk to you and you talk to me.
Are you going on a date, Sanborn?
My team leader is inspiring. Wow. He's gonna get me killed.
What's the best way to go about disarming one of these things?
The way you don't die, sir.
That was good.
What do we have here?
This box is full of stuff. It almost killed me.
What about this one? Where's this one from, Will?
It's my wedding ring. Like I said, stuff that almost killed me.
Put down the phone!
Brown him, Aldrin!
I can't get a shot!
I was scared.
Yeah? Well, everyone's a coward about something.
We're going on a mission. And my job is to keep you safe so we can keep going on mission.
It's combat, buddy.
Go!
Everybody get back!
Go, go, go!
You realize every time you suit up, it's life or death.
Found something.
You roll the dice. And you deal with it.
Oh, boy.
And that was the trailer for Hurt Locker, which is the latest film from Kathryn Bigelow. Kathryn Bigelow started in the 80s with the film Near Dark and has directed films such as Point Break, K-19, Widowmaker, and Strange Days. Now, I actually personally think that this is probably one of her best films, but we'll get to that in a second. Now, the story basically revolves about a demolitions team in Iraq who are called in to take care of bombs. So when the patrols out there discover a car bomb or something strange or wire sticking out of the ground, they call in the demolitions team who come in and basically try and defuse the bomb or make sure that it's ready for removal by somebody else. The film stars Jeremy Renner, Anthony Mackie, Brian, now I'm going to massacre this last name, I'm sorry, Gerhati, I think it is. And it has small appearances by Guy Pearce, Ralph Fiennes, and David Morse, and Evangeline Lilly for those Lost fans out there. Now, I have to say that I actually thought this was a tense film. There's no doubt about that. I don't think it is. I'm not quite sure if I'm going to put it in the realm of being one of the greatest films ever made. This film is getting a lot of press. Mm. People are saying it's one of the best films of the year and blah, blah. I thought it was a good film. I enjoyed it. It kept my attention. I thought very tense. Mm. I thought that it has a really nice atmosphere on the entire film that really puts you kind of on edge. And I thought Jeremy Renner was fabulous. I thought his character, from the minute he enters the film with his cavalier cowboy attitude towards how he deals with stuff, I thought he was terrific. Mm. But yeah, and I would recommend it. I would say that if you are interested in a good Iraq film, because let's face it, there haven't been that many films that have come out about Iraq that have actually been that good a film. Mm. This is actually one of the better ones. And I think Kathryn Bigelow really does prove that she can direct up there with the boys. You know, I mean, she really, it does not feel, and she's always been that way. She doesn't direct, like, she doesn't direct fluffy, Clueless type, you know.
No.
When I say Clueless, I mean the movie Clueless or you know, fluffy, you know, romantic comedies or anything like that. She directs balls to the wall, boy Actions. Films.
Yeah.
And she's done it again. I mean, this is a woman who was married to James Cameron at some point, so you can imagine that there's a lot of that has rubbed off on her as well. So what did you think, Josh?
I go with you on that. It was an enjoyable film. I have to say there are certain things, as usual, that I had problems with in the movie. I felt the ending came too sudden. Didn't really like the way it finished.
We're not going to go into spoilers on this film, but no. Just to say, I don't like the transition to the ending.
No, that's yeah. That, it's exactly
I didn't mind
about.
Where how they did it. I didn't mind what the plan was for the ending. I just didn't think they executed it very well.
I just thought it was really sloppy, and it was like they had a brilliant movie and a brilliant concept, and I just wasn't ready for that ending. I figured there was going to be something more. There was going to be a bit more emphasis on what they do. Maybe a bit of a sort of a climactic final scene or whatever. I just did not feel that the ending, even before that bit, at the very end, the sort of the tallying up to where they do their finish was just really you know, it was unspectacular.
It felt a little bit... The ending of the film felt a little bit slapdash. It almost felt like we got this idea for the ending. We know what we're going to do, but we're not quite sure how to pull this off.
Mm.
And I can understand where she went with the ending, and I can understand what she was trying to say.
Yeah.
But I don't think it was well executed is the key here. I have to say that the film obviously had some impact because my lovely wife, Katie, actually could not watch the film.
Which I found really interesting.
She actually found it... suspenseful because of the entire atmosphere is they keep you on edge the whole time. She found it was making her stressed out.
And I think the interesting point that we both raised were no character in this movie feels safe.
No, absolutely not.
Like, I mean, I would like to argue slightly against your point that I felt
the only one that I actually felt safe with was Jeremy Renner.
Yeah.
I never felt, and I guess.
Which is strange because I was kind of hoping that maybe they would play on that and maybe do the complete opposite or something like that. Something where you could actually kind of, you could finalize that feeling of fear and tension in it. But I found that the good thing about it was that you felt like no one in the movie you were watching was this character that was safe. It was almost like Tarantino with Inglourious Basterds where none of the support cast... You knew whether they were going to survive or die, and that really, to me, put that level of tension on it that was really special, like the way that every time they would do these, it was almost like shot in small bits, you know, like each bit was its own little story, their own little event. It was like someone retelling all these events because it would just, bam, straight start into it. You'd get a quick, it was almost like watching a TV episode. It's like, what have we got today? Well, we've got this and you've got to go do that. And those were really good because that tension was held because anything could happen.
I agree with that 100%. There were a couple of standout scenes. There are a couple of moments, well, actually several standout scenes in this film. The sniper scene was really nicely handled. It was incredibly tense. It was unpredictable. It was, and I think it's a really that we saw a real growth to the character who was the younger member of the team, not the diehard sergeant, not Jeremy Renner's sergeant, but the younger one who kind of follows it. They refer to him as specialist.
Yeah, specialist
all the way through it. And there's a nice growth to him in that character because he has to actually shoot that guy and blah blah blah. We won't go into any details away. But that's the fact that they have to sit there so long waiting. Mm.
Just in case.
Just like, in case. And the tension, you just... Because the sniper bullets were coming without sound, because the person was so far away, you never had... You never knew when it was going to come next, you know? And that was actually really well handled. Although some people have actually said they think it's one of the best sniper scenes in film, I actually think that Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket still stands out as probably the number one sniper scene of cinema history. That scene near the end of the film was grueling at the end of Full Metal Jacket. But
I'd just like to bring up, I love what Furballs put on the thing there where he says, it went out with a whimper, not a bang.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's the perfect description.
Absolutely.
Of the
movie. And I like the Dademeyer says that maybe, he says his wife has said that maybe it was her that rubbed off on the Cameron, not the other way around. Ooh. You know what? And considering that her first film was Near Dark, which was before she met Cameron, there might be something to that because it was Near Dark actually stars a lot of the cast of Aliens.
And interesting.
Interesting.
Point.
So, Near Dark is a fabulous film if you haven't seen it. And I've actually loaned it to Josh. So hopefully,
I'm planning to watch it very soon.
We might do a retro review on Near Dark at some point. If you haven't seen Near Dark, it's an '80s vampire film, which is really interesting.
We'll come back to that.
So I think there's that and some of the bomb defusing scenes you were pointing out. There's that one scene outside the UN building with the car, which was actually very tense. That scene where they're basically telling him to step away. It's time to go. But Jeremy Renner just was absolutely determined.
One of my favorite scenes of the movie is just is the bit where he's throwing his headset out of the window. And the guy's like, can you please tell him that we have to go? And he just sticks his hand out the side of the window and pulls the finger. He's just, that's not going to happen.
And the other line I love, of course, and I mean, this is kind of spoilerish, but the other line I love when they are helping the mercenaries out in the desert and he says, what happened to your wrench? And he goes, I threw it at somebody. And he goes, you do know we can shoot people here. We don't have to throw a wrench. It's like there's some really good lines. It's got really, I mean, as I say, Jeremy Renner is a find. And I think I referred to him as Michael Renner before, but Jeremy Renner is a find. I think he was actually very, very interesting in the role of William James. From the minute he appears on screen, which is about 10 minutes into the film, there's just this cavalier cowboy attitude to him that really...
I think it's one of the... Like, I can't wait to see him in more things.
Yeah,
because he really stood out to me, and I loved the presence. And again, in the bomb scene, one of my favorite lines, I think it's in the trailer, I'm not sure, is where he just starts stripping all the gear off.
Yes, it's in the trailer,
Because I just... It wasn't the line, it was the way that it was portrayed. It was that whole kind of everyone else hiding and him just kind of dumping it and going, if I'm going to die...
I'm going to die comfortable.
I'm going to die comfortable. Yeah. And you can kind of... You can see both things. Like there's...
And there's that wonderful line where he meets up with... what's the actor's name? David Morse. When he meets up with David Morse's character, and he goes, "Hot damn!" He goes, "You do this for a living?" He goes, "How many of these have you detonated? Have you diffused?" And the guy goes, "I don't remember." He goes, "No, come on, how many did you?" He goes, "Oh, 835." And it's like, what? He's been doing this for a long time because they actually make reference at the beginning of the film that he's actually been transferred in from Afghanistan.
Mm.
So he's obviously been doing this for a long time, and he is probably more qualified than any other member on that team to be doing it. Because he has no fear of it. And he just goes in and does it. So great. It is a good film. Don't get us wrong. It is a good film. I don't think it's the best film ever made.
It's definitely not the best film of this year either. No. But one other scene I would like everyone to watch out for is the scene where they are detonating charges in the desert. I thought that scene was really creepy.
Oh, yes. Yeah. The interchange of dialogue in that scene.
Just the way that scene pans out. And the way that the feeling it puts on the rest of the movie between the three main characters is very interesting.
And that, in connection with the scene when they're hitting each other, you know, when they're in the
they're hitting each other. Wow.
There's a lot of internal conflict in the unit.
And it's handled in such a strange way because none of them are kind of sort of opposing each other at any stage in the movie, but there's always that psychological fear of each other.
Yeah.
Which I thought, very, very well.
Yeah, no, it is a good film. It is well worth catching up with. As we say, it comes out in Australia in a couple of months. It's out in America now at the cinemas. It is worth going to have a look at. It is not for the faint at heart. It is a very tense film. Mm. And you will sit on the edge of your seat through a lot of it. And it's not because it's scary. And a lot of it actually doesn't have payoff, so to speak. Mm. But it's that tension I've never been to Iraq during wartime, so I can't say what it's really like, but just the idea that when they're defusing bombs and they have to keep watching the skylines at all time to make sure that the person who's going to trigger that bomb isn't standing around or there isn't a sniper and there's this constant fear for their lives always. It is really, I'm on record as saying that I objected to the Iraqi war. That's got nothing to do about the servicemen. And I think that, we have to say that they are doing a wonderful job in doing their job. And let's get them home. And this film really highlights to me, let's get them home. Yeah. because they really deserve to come home now. Anyway, we're going to move on. I'd say that is a thumbs up from both of us. And I think it just infringed at the movie's copyright with that. But that's all right. We're going to move on to The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. Now, for those who have not seen Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, it is actually based on a book by Brian Goody, I want to say his name is. John Goody. Actually, it's John Goody, I think it's pronounced. I don't know. I could be massacring his last name. Anyway, this film, it was originally filmed in 74, I think it was. 74, yes, I was right. 1974 by Joseph Sargent. And this film had such an impact at the time. I got to tell you, I've just been reading up on it. Apparently, they actually stopped running trains from Pelham Station at 1:23 in the afternoon for many years after the film came out because of the connotations to the film, because that's what the Pelham 1-2-3 stands for. And they've now started running them again now. But for a long time, they did not run a 1:23 train from Pelham because of the impact of the 1974 film. The film basically is, and this is the new film now, it's the same in both, it's basically about a train, the Pelham 1-2-3, which is actually hijacked by four people who then make demands on the city, basically holding hostages. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's basically a roundup of the synopsis. You can go first on this one. We're going to run the trailer on this. Now, we're going to approach this review slightly differently, as I said at the beginning. We're going to approach this review as somebody who's taking the film as just the film themselves, which is going to be Josh, who's on camera now. And then I'm going to take the film and I'm going to review it as a comparison to the 1974 film. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't normally compare films when we try and do a remake. Yes, I mean, it's inevitable that you often do, but you try and take a film for its own merit. Mm-hmm. But we just thought, because the film is already out, we would actually take this slightly different approach this time, because we had this unique position that Josh had never seen the original. All right, so here we go. We're going to run the trailer here. Let's see what you think of this.
Okay, I'm going to need the R train to switch over to the express tracks at 34th Street.
Lock the door.
Do it now or I'll kill you.
Everybody out! This side's facing the window.
Control center calling Pelham 1-2-3. Why'd you stop 1-2-3? You're all green ahead.
Rail control center, do you read me?
Who is this?
This is a man who's gonna give this city a run for the money.
Now what is the price for New York City hostages this morning?
What do you think, a million a piece is too high?
Oh, I'm not a hostage negotiator. I'm a civil service employee.
Oh, I think you'll do just fine. Now, what time do you got on your watch?
2:13.
59 minutes, I'm gonna start killing passengers.
You don't want innocent people dying, do you?
You tell me.
Life is simple now. You just have to do what I say.
Call the mayor now.
Somebody just hijacked Pelham 1-2-3.
You don't think this was fate, you and me?
You know, I'm just a guy. I'm just a guy on the other end of the mic.
I do like you, man. You may be the last friend I ever make.
How are you going to get the money here?
They're shutting down every intersection from here to Brooklyn.
The money's on the way.
Look out!
There was an accident.
Now somebody else has to die.
Those cops are going to be down that tunnel.
Got an easy shot, please advise.
Let them unload on me!
I want to make you a deal. I will trade you for all these passengers.
You don't have to do this.
They want me to take the money down to the tunnel.
You do what you have to do, but we need milk. So on your way home, I want you to bring a gallon.
I could get a half a gallon. I'll get a half a gallon.
You're just like me, Garber.
No, you use one of these?
You got 5 seconds.
Okay.
Five, four.
We didn't know how the day was going to start.
Three.
I know exactly how it was going to start.
Two.
Yeah, but do you know how it's going to end?
Okay, that was the trailer for The Taking of Pelham 123, the remake with John Travolta and Denzel Washington. I'm going to throw this over to Josh to start us off with. Okay, Josh, let it rip.
A lot of preparation went into this film. I need to explain this very carefully, to explain the entire situation of how well I prepared for this movie, because I was worried about my own personal way of viewing this film and that it wouldn't be unbiased. So I did the following things. I went into my mind and I flicked on the Friday night movie switch, which for me is the movie switch where I try and dull every other feeling in my head. I just go, I'm just going to a film to enjoy it.
That's what I refer to as disengage brain now.
Exactly. But you see, that's the thing. I also went through and I hit a couple of other switches while I was there. I switched off my I don't like Tony Scott switch. I flicked off my switch, which is I know that Denzel will play exactly the same character as he always does switch. I turned that off and I disengaged my brain. Like you said, I did all that. And on top of that, I went to see this at the Ritz. And I did that so that I was paying less. I was paying $12 for a ticket, which is a much better price. And I used that money to buy popcorn and a drink. So I set myself in every possible way up for this film. And you know what? At the end of the day, it was okay. No, that's it. That's pretty much my review. It was okay. The acting is okay. It's average. The plot is average. The on-screen presence between characters is average. And the cinematics, the way it was shot, is average. I mean, like, there is nothing standout about this movie. There is no scenes that stand out about this movie. There is no dialogue that stands out about this movie. Mm-hmm. This movie is, in every form of the word, average. I did not enjoy it. I just didn't feel anything for it. I walked out of the cinema and went, yeah, that's done. Yeah. It's finished. It's done. I would like to make one up thing for it. I would like to make one positive reinforcement, which is that it is very nice to see Travolta playing a bad guy again.
Yes.
Because the man was meant to play bad roles. He is perfect for being evil. And I love him when he's evil.
I have to say that I actually, just on this film, without looking at the other film at this point, on this film, I have to say that I actually agree with you 100%. The final resultant for me was average.
Yeah.
I think there were actually some things that were very good, and I think there were some things that were actually really mediocre, but they balance out to being average. And I thought Travolta was actually very good.
I thought Travolta
was having so much fun playing this bad guy. And I've not been a big fan of Travolta's lately.
No.
I thought he was having a lot of fun with this role, and I thought he actually came across as very maniacal, and that was fine. I actually thought Denzel actually did a nice job, because Denzel
really?
Was... Because
it was the same role!
No, this is where I disagree with you, because I actually think Denzel doesn't usually play the meeker character, and he was actually playing a very every guy, because he's usually Denzel, you know, and he's the, I mean, you think about all of his most recent films, he has been the more heroic type. He wasn't that heroic in this film, and I actually kind of like the fact that he played down that Denzel a little bit, and so that balanced out for me. I actually hated the way it was shot.
I
am so... And so it sounds so funny coming off of Hurt Locker, which is also shot in handheld, but I am so over the Bourne Identity style overkill slash camp, throw cameras around everywhere. And the difference is the Hurt Locker is handheld cameras, and it makes you feel like you're in the action. What Tony Scott has done is he's actually directed a film And it's like he's throwing his camera everywhere to hide the fact that nothing really is happening.
interestingly enough, the few points that I wanted to bring up about that was I was actually going to let that slide because we'd talked so much lately about handheld and how it can be handled well.
Oh, but
not
it's
handled
so
well.
Obvious. In this
I
film.
Know, I know. And so again, obvious. Why I was going to let it go. But more to the point, and this is what I'd like to bring back, I hate, further than the handheld nature of this thing, the Hollywood obsession lately of explaining your shots with these ridiculous zoom in, zoom out camera shots.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know what the hilarious part was? While I was thinking about that and being so angry about it, the girl beside me, just like straight after the scene where it shoots up into this, you know, giant sort of GPS style thing and goes whoosh, over to where they are and then whoosh, over to where they're going and then down, the girl goes, where are they going? I'm just like, Jesus Christ, how much more reactive do we have to make it?
The thing that annoyed me about this so much, though, this camera work, was the fact that there's one shot where they're in the helicopter, and they're flying in the helicopter, and the shot is the helicopter flying across the skyline. The entire background is just blurred background, and there's this helicopter, and then we cut to inside, and John Turturro says, it looks so different when you look at it from up here. I don't know. We couldn't see it.
I saw a blur. I may have seen a building or two.
Nothing. It was a complete style over substance with all of the camera work. And I don't mind. I actually don't mind handheld camera work. It worked really well in Hurt Locker. It works really well in Bourne Identity. But the problem is, I think what happens is we go, oh, that worked. Let's go really wild with it. And I think what's happened is we've gone to this extreme when we're throwing stuff everywhere. Mm. And these
oh, even the music.
The music was out of. The music was overdone.
I think the worst choice ever for introduction movies. Like, I am, in some essence, a rap fan. But the idea of having a song by Jay-Z called 99 Problems, a very famous song, which has no relevance to the intro thing, doesn't fit. I mean, they're trying to make this kind of gritty, quick switching, you know, sort of. It fell apart, and the music just felt so like I'm trying to make the scene incredibly interesting with a whole bunch of people standing on a train platform waiting for a train. Why do we have to make that so energetic? Why can't we just build the tension in the scene by just follow these characters with you having no idea of what's going on?
All right, Popshot has actually raised a very interesting point in the chat room. Popshot has actually said, what do you think you guys were going to get out of this movie? Well, I'm going to answer that. And I'm going to say what I expected to get out of this movie is what the 1974 version delivered.
Well, that's an interesting point because we can both raise this on different issues. Yeah. What did I go into it expecting? I expected an above-average, run-of-the-mill action thriller. And that's pretty much what I got.
And this is the thing. I think David Stratton of our At the Movies in this country actually summed it up best. And I don't like to use other reviewers often, but he just summed this up so well when he actually said, if you have not seen the 1974 version of The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, this is a very average actioner that is fine. And it's quite entertaining, and you'll, you know, disengage your brain and have fun. If you have seen the 1974 version, you will actually realize how low our movies have come today.
Mm.
Basically, looking back on this past film, let me have a look at this comparison. Okay, the 1974 version of Taking Pelham 1-2-3 is actually also not a super accurate version of the book. I have not read the book, and I've been looking online, and Data Mike in our chat room has actually read the book and has seen both versions of the film. So he can actually drop in here and actually tell us what the major differences are. Now, Wikipedia actually has a breakdown of some of the differences, and, you know, overall, though, I would have to actually say that I think the 74 version sounds like it is actually a little bit closer to the new version. Now, the 74 version is a very simple film, and there's going to be spoilers here, guys, but the film is close to 40 years old, so I'm not going to worry about spoilers on this. If you haven't seen The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, go rent it from your local DVD store, and you can see it. In the original version of The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, Walter Matthau plays a transit detective. He's a transit cop, and he basically gets drawn into all of this when the Pelham train, leaving Pelham at 1:23, gets hijacked by four mysterious people wearing trench coats, glasses, and mustaches and hats. They all look exactly the same, and it's actually where Tarantino got the idea for his opening. They're all named Mr. Blue, Mr. Pink, Mr. What have you. Mm. And they basically hijack this train. They release all the other cars. They keep just the lead car of the train. They release all the other people. They keep the 18 hostages on the train and basically say to the city they have 1 hour to pay them $1 million or they're going to execute the prisoners. It's as simple as that. And Walter Matthau ends up having to be the go-between between him and everybody else. But this film has such a simple premise, such simple characters, and yet is much more suspenseful than the new version, because you are in a situation where we don't have modern technology. We are they can't be aware of what is going on down in the car. We don't have cell phones. We don't have GPS satellite coordinates. We don't have
streaming
video. No, we don't have anything. And in the film, you actually have Walter Matthau continually having to go between four different microphones trying to coordinate the street cops up on the street and talking to the Pelham down here and talking to his other cop buddies on other platforms. And so you've got all of this communication. And now, this is actually a very major point to the original taking of Pelham 123, which is that New York itself is a character in the film. This is not the case in the new version. Yes, they set the new film in New York. Yes, it's about the New York subway. Yes, it's, you know, they keep making all these references about how this is New York and blah, but you never get a flavor of New York. Mm. And the new film never has this flavor of New York. Everything in the original 74 version is just seeping in New York. The accents, the characters, the attitude of Walter Matthau on the microphone to Mr. Blue when he's talking to Robert Charles, like he'll hang up the phone and go, yeah, fuck you. I mean, we've got these thick Bronx accents on everybody. And also there's a time and place issue. The original film has got this absolute misogyny and racism attached to it. Just the way they refer to each other and they talk about each other. Like at one point they find out there's an undercover cop on the train. They don't know who it is. Mm. And they're saying, and Walter Matthau basically says, yeah, what can one undercover cop do, especially if it's a dame, you know? And all this sort of stuff. These characters are so rough around the edges that you feel everything that's going on with them. You relate to these characters. Now, countering that is the leader of the four gunmen, played by Robert Shaw, who is British. And so you've got this cold, calculating British voice on the other end of the line who basically doesn't give... There's no psychopathy to Robert Shaw's character. And this is the one thing that John Travolta plays up. He plays it like he's come out of prison and he's this gangster and all this sort of stuff. Whereas in the original, it is cold, it is calculated, and it is planned perfectly. Mm. Everything about the heist is this meticulously planned thing to how they actually communicate with each other on the train and the whole bit. And then the original film also adds an inner turmoil because there is a conflict between one of the gunmen and Robert Shaw, because one of the gunmen, played by Hector Elizondo, is actually kind of like a ringer who was brought in, and they don't trust each other, and he's worried about him. So you've actually got this internal conflict that's happening as well between him and one of his own people. Mm. You've got Walter Matthau trying to keep it all together. You've got the mayor in the original film is actually suffering from the flu and doesn't want to leave his house. And so you've got all this humor happening because they're basically saying, you have to get up and come in now. You have to try and work out what's going on with the Pelham. Even the exchange of money when the car gets hit and crashes, which you see in the new version, that is not heavily played up in the original. Yes, it gets crashed. Yes, the car crashes. Yes, the motorcycle cops grab the money. But it's not like, I mean, Tony Scott just had to say, everything in this film we're going to overdo. So we're not just going to have the car get crashed. We're going to throw it off a bridge. We're going to have it roll over. We're going to get hit by another car. It's like, settle down, man. And this is the final thought on all of this is that the original film, where I say New York is such a character, probably has fewer shots of New York than the remake does. Because a lot of it takes place in rooms. A lot of it takes place, yes, there are some street shots, but a lot of it takes place in the control center, in the train, or with the cops. And you sit there and go, yet, even though we're not doing all these, you know, blurry vistas of New York, we really feel New York permeating throughout this entire film. I think the original taking of Pelham 123, yes, it's dated. Yes, we look at it now, we go, you know, this film does reek of 1974 filmmaking, but it is a tenser film. It keeps your attention. I tell you what, I actually never once wondered what time it was during the watching of Taking of Pelham 123 1974 version. I looked at my watch twice during the Tony Scott version. Because with the Tony Scott version, I'm sitting there, by the time we're getting halfway through the film, I'm starting to go, well, you know, we're not building any suspense here. I'm not wondering where this is going to go. You know, is really, and even though they took liberties with the plot, I mean, one of the main characters in the original 74 version, and this is spoilers, guys, I just warn you, there are a few spoilers here, but in the 1974 version, a character who is carried right to the end of the film is the train driver character. In the Ridley Scott version, we kill him off halfway through the film. And he's actually a very major...
Interesting that the line as well that, what's his face, John Travolta's character says in the film, again, guys, we're kind of in spoiler zone, so yeah.
We're going to declare this a spoiler zone at this point.
Is where he actually points the gun at him and says the line, you were always going to be the first one to go.
No, I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about the train driver that Travolta brought on.
Oh, you mean the one that he brought on?
Yeah, the train driver that Travolta actually brought.
I feel sorry for that guy because I swear to God, he always either gets killed or just...
What's his name? Louis Guzman?
And the poor guy, just like, I saw him in the film, I'm like, oh, wow, I wonder whether he's going to be that character that just...
And in the original film, that character played by Martin Balsam, and he's actually a major player. He is important, and he stays all the way to the end. And the original film, what makes the original film really neat is for... And it's not played out. The ending is very different in the remake. But in the original film, it's this fascinating idea that you have such a meticulously worked out plan that in the last 10 minutes of the film, one mistake and the entire thing just unravels. And that's what makes the original film so interesting, is that the entire finale takes place literally within 10 minutes. And it just unravels so fast because of one mistake. And they actually play up a little bit more on the fact that there is a cop on board the train, which is a complete throwaway in Tony Scott's version, you know? And I'm sorry, you don't think they would have noticed in the Tony Scott version, you don't think they would have noticed this laptop that was live streaming?
I totally agree.
The whole time that they're doing this?
Well, it's interesting because Popshot brought up an interesting point that he said when he watched the trailer, this looks a lot like phone booth. I totally agree. There's that whole kind of feeling at the start that I thought that this thing was going to be entirely dialogue between the two people. I mean, I had no concept of what I was watching. I mean, I'd seen all these other things, but it always seemed like the main thing was between the two of them. I started to enjoy that because my only reason to keep myself entertained for the entire start of this bit was the wiry nature of John Travolta's character. I just loved the way that he seemed so calculating at times and then just so loose and frenzied at other times, and I think that was what held me in the thing, because I wanted to know what he was going to do.
I agree. The two standout performances for me in this film were John Travolta stood out. I mean, this is the film that he's been waiting for a while. I just wish the film could have been better for his character. But I thought he was really good. And I also really like John Turturro's character. And
It was nice to see him not...
It was nice to see him not hamming it up for once.
Yeah, exactly. Well, because the role was so similar, in my opinion, to the kind of nature of his character in the Transformers thing.
Yeah, but without the campy stupidness.
Without the campy stupidness, and he was intelligent, and, like, I was worried at first, at the start scene where he first gets introduced, and I was just like, oh, God, they're just going to play him off as the same guy again, and I worried that that was going to stereotype him. But I thought he was okay. He was actually handled all right towards the end of the movie, just being the kind of supporting... buddy, pat on the shoulder kind of guy for Denzel's character, who
because he was sympathetic. And when he first makes that appearance, and he does all of that condemning, where he's basically saying, "You sure you don't know him?" and all, and I'm not thinking, yeah, whatever. But by halfway through the film, he is there to support Denzel, and I really like. I thought he did a nice job on that. What are we saying here? We're saying. Furball is actually saying,
especially action, when it's action for action's sake, yeah.
There are times when tension trumps action. Absolutely. And this is actually, there are times when tension trumps action could actually be referred to the Hurt Locker amazingly well. Because you sit
it's
there
funny
and go,
that we've got the two, because we've got like two totally different.
And they are two suspense thrillers, and yet one succeeded in that and one didn't. Because taking a Pelham 1-2-3 remake does not.
No.
Hold suspense.
No.
And it is unfortunate because it is a great story when played out right. And I really want you to see the Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. I really want you to see the original.
I plan to. Everything you've said makes me want to watch it.
And if it nothing, is worth it watching may just actually, for the character interplay.
Yeah. If nothing else, I think for me, the reason I really want to watch it is I now think I'm going to enjoy that movie more because I've watched this incredibly average film.
Absolutely.
And it will be nice to... I'm assuming that when I watch it, I'm not going to be like, wow, that was a great, amazing, well-done movie.
But I'll give you a hint as well. I watched the original again a couple of days ago in preparation for this, and my lovely wife Katie watched it with me, and so did Nicholas. Now, Nicholas is 10, and he often gets bored of the movies I'm watching and wanders off. Mm. But he actually stayed with it, and he actually really enjoyed the original as well. So the original is a really good film from an era of filmmaking, let's face it, where they did really good cop stuff.
Yeah.
French Connection, you know, stands out, The Godfather, and so forth. We had a lot of great crime films. And what the original is a really good caper film.
Mm.
And it really sets out to do that, and it does it very well. And I got to say, kudos to Robert Shaw. Robert Shaw is actually, unfortunately, he died in the, I think it was the late 70s, early 80s, but Robert Shaw had such a presence on screen. Films like Jaws, which is one of my favorites, is Quint. And in this, he is just, he is menacing because of his stillness. Mm. And that's something that John Travolta didn't have. Robert Shaw has this cold, calculating stillness to him, and it makes him dangerous. So, I would actually say, out of the two films, definitely watch the original. The new film, go see it if you want to just disengage your brain, eat popcorn, drink Coke, and just have, you know, some mild entertainment. It is really, I would say, rent it. I would have said if the camera work worked, go see it on the big screen just for its dynamics, but it doesn't work.
No.
And in fact, I think it'll probably actually work better on the small screen.
I think it is the perfect movie to watch for a disengaging Friday night kind of a film that you rent from the video store on your way home.
Absolutely.
I think you will get a better feeling out of that than you would if you got out of your house, went, you know, out, got dinner somewhere, and then went to the movie. You would be disappointed, whereas if you watch it at home on your TV, I think it could actually be much more enjoyable.
I agree. I think this is definitely a rental, as my mother would say. All right, we're going to wrap this up. I've got to play us one more video clip because Little Geek has been hard at work in his little studio, and I saw this, and he did this all on his own, and I thought it was very amusing, so I'm going to play it here for our viewers in the chat room. For those who are listening to the audio podcast, you can go to geekactually.com and you can find it. He actually animated some Lego to an excerpt from our show. So I'm going to play that for you now, and this is just because it is so cute. Okay, and we're back with the Little Geek. Hello, Nicholas. How are you?
I'm all right.
Now, Little Geek, 3D glasses on. 3D glasses on because, of course, we are now going to talk to the Little Geek about his opinion of the film Coraline. So now, this is actually kind of one of the reasons why we get you on this show, Nicholas, is because when it comes to films like Coraline and other family-rated fare, we like to get the perspective of the age group that it's actually aimed at. So joining me on this little section here, Josh has returned. Hello, Josh. How are you? And Katrina had to leave us, unfortunately, but we thank Katrina again. Okay, so Nicholas, first impressions. What did you think of Coraline?
It was a really cute film.
Really cute film?
Yeah.
Now, you've seen Nightmare Before Christmas, haven't you?
Yeah.
And you've seen Corpse Bride.
Yeah.
But you haven't seen James and the Giant Peach. All right, so that we must rectify, actually. Really?
So when you watch that...
We must rectify this.
because Tiff was saying that it was an incredible movie. I was like, you know what?
I didn't think it was as good as Nightmare Before Christmas, I must say. I didn't think it was as good. But it is a good animated film. Out of Henry Selick's animated films, in particular, your point of reference will be...
Did you know I thought Corpse Bride was freakier than Nightmare Before Christmas?
Well, yeah, to be fair, though, because we got... Okay, so that was Nicholas's little animated film there, which I thought was very cute. Let me just kill the sound there. There we go. That's better. Oh, I've lost my station logo. There we go. Yeah, that was. I'm not going to run the credits because the credits basically just advertise the show. He's put this up on YouTube for us. It's kind of like our first ad, Josh.
Yeah, I guess in a way it is, isn't it?
So I thought that was very cute, and good on you for doing that. We're going to wrap this up. We're going to say that you can send feedback to our show at any time if you agree or disagree with any of our takes on our film reviews. You are welcome welcome to voice your opinions at feedback@geekactually.com, or use the contact form on the website, or you can put comments straight down in the comments field of any post, or alternatively, you can go to geekactually.com/forum, and we often put up, or we always put up now, a link to the latest show in the forum, and you can voice your opinions in the forum, which Josh is moderating for us, which is very nice. We do accept donations because this show is actually completely independent, and we do run completely on the support of our listeners. If you do want to make a donation, you can click the support us link on geekactually.com. Every little cent helps and goes to the show. Please keep your comments coming into iTunes, American store, or Australian store, English store, I don't care, any store. We're really trying to make our ways up the ranks. We are growing every week in audience listener, and we'd like to keep that growing even more. Let's get the word out there. So please put your reviews up there on the iTunes store. If you want to get in touch with me, you can easily get in touch with me by sending any feedback to the show, come straight to me, or you can Twitter me at twitter.com/DavidMcVeigh, all one word. You can also friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/DavidMcVeigh. Josh, how this week can we get in touch with you?
I don't know. I was actually thinking about it leading up. Well, the only thing I can think of is at your local movie theater. I have literally been to, I think, a movie every couple of days lately at different cinemas all over Sydney. So, yeah, I think that's... that's where you can find me at the moment. That, and of course, my either my Twitter account, which I found out is Dogmeat with a 3 instead of an E.
DOGM380.
Yeah, or through the website or through Facebook, where I am under Facebook/GeekJosh.
Geek Josh, okay. And you can catch up with us more next week. We will be back next week. We're going to review the film Up, which I know for the Americans is a little bit late, but we're getting it. Pixar, for some reason, always comes out a couple months late. I'm also going to talk a little bit about a new film called Paper Heart, which I happen to catch, which has just started in limited release in America. We'll talk about that next week as well. Little Geek will be on next week as well to talk about his opinions of Up. And we are finally going to get to Pop Shot's request and talk about Roughnecks. Yeah. Sorry, Pop Shot's taken us so long to get there.
Yes, it was just the two movies this week. It was going to run well over 2 hours.
Absolutely.
If we did that.
If we're keeping it under 2 hours, we've got to limit what we can do. In the meantime, go see more movies. You don't see enough movies. All of life's questions are answered in the movies, and we will talk to you more next week. Maybe.